Welcome to the local brown bagger on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. Our speaker today has an urgent message for you. Slow down and enjoy your life. Cecil Andrews is a community educator from Seattle and author of Slow is Beautiful, New Visions of Community, Leisure, and Joie de Vivre. She spoke at the Vancouver Public Library on March 5th, 2007, and we'd like to thank the Necessary Voices Society for this recording. Here is Cecil Andrews.
Part of the slow life, and it's interesting, because talking about the slow life, some people would be like horrified. They think, oh no, I don't want anything about the slow life. And I was trying to figure out what, under what age would that be? Would it be 18 and under that they would be horrified by the slow life? 25? 30? What do you think? Ah, okay. Well, I think there might be a little bit of age in there, though. But the idea, I think you all know what I'm talking about, is waking up in the morning and looking forward to your day instead of feel clutched in your stomach right away, and being able to take your time and have time for the things that matter and to hang out. And at the evening, I've begun to think that for some of us, that the high point of our day is crossing something off of our to-do list. Like, that's as good as it gets. You know, it's like we're so overwhelmed that we just keep, you know, we don't have any real joy except crossing something off the list. And so I started to think, well, those of us in a slow life, what we do is we try to cross things off of our list even if we haven't done them. We just start going through. So that's what we'll talk about. How do you get to that point where you're crossing those things off? And I think, you know, I've seen this frenzy that a lot of people are in just expand so quickly. It used to be when I'd see my friends, I'd say, hello, how are you? And they'd say, fine. And then I'd see people and they'd say, how are you? And they'd say, oh, busy, busy. And of course, it makes you feel like saying, okay, then I'll just move right along. Because, you know, who's going to want to take time if they're telling you they're busy? And now what people are saying is, I say, how are you? And they say, slammed. And I think, what kind of an answer is that? That people feel slammed. And then you start, it's kind of like we've got to be able to see what bizarre lives we've started to live. And I like to ask people about things they've seen people do in cars. And, you know, while they're driving. Does anybody have something that they've seen that they think is just too odd for words in while they're driving? What do you have? Well, no, I was driving along and I saw this guy's head kept going down like this, like that. And then he brought his cereal to his mouth. So that's what he was doing. He was eating his cereal. And then people tell me they see people reading and text messaging, of course, cell phones. And one woman told me that her daughter could change her entire suit of clothes, including pantyhose, while she was driving. And so, It's you know, we're talking about the art of living, and there's a South African poet, Brayton Breytenbach, who said, and he said this about Americans, he said, Americans have mastered the art of living with the unacceptable. Don't you love that? Have mastered the art of living with the unacceptable. So a lot of what we're talking about is to say that this isn't the way we're supposed to be living. And so it's interesting because for years, I've been talking about this for a long time, and for the last several years, I've been talking about the subject of voluntary simplicity. And, you know, people trying to consume less so they can work less and have more time for the things they want to do. But it's been a really hard topic to talk to people about, because people are drawn to simplicity, but they're afraid of it. And I realized this several years ago. It was a 20-something son of a friend of mine. He said to his mother, he said, what's that thing your friend Cecile's involved in, that self-deprivation movement? And I thought, you know, oh, this is not it at all. We're trying to get people to enjoy their lives more. And so we've really worked on that. But then just a year ago, I thought, oh, I have to give up. Again, we had, he was in his early 20s, and he was a friend of the family's, and he was visiting, and he was reading all this stuff on my refrigerator. And I noticed he was starting to read my grocery list, which I had just started. And he said, oh, whoa, he said, you really walk your talk. And I said, what? And I came over there, and on the grocery list, it said, bread and water. So I said, no, this is expensive organic bread. This is sparkling water for a party. But it was this expectation that we're denying ourselves, that we're cutting back and not enjoying ourselves at all. And so, as I said, it became harder and harder to talk about simplicity, and even harder, of course, since Madison Avenue has discovered it, you know, simplify your life, buy a Honda. It's like they've used this idea to sell things. And then I discovered, as probably a lot of you know about, I discovered the whole slow food movement. And I thought, this is just brilliant. First, it was started as a joke when McDonald's moved into Rome and the Italians realized what would happen if they had a fast food nation like the U.S., because that's not why people go to Italy. And so they made a joke about this. And what they were saying is, people are not supposed to be eating with one hand while they're driving. They're not supposed to be eating tasteless food while they're watching television. You're supposed to take the whole evening and you eat with your friends and family and you have good food and good conversation and a lot of laughter and good wine. And this is the vision of slow food. But then they went further, which I love this part of it. You know, if you're going to have good food, then you have to pay attention to how it's being grown. So they looked at environmental issues and organic and genetically modified. And so then they even went further. You have to look at who's growing it. What are the corporations doing to it? So they have this idea, the slow food movement, which is really, really a metaphor for our lives. And to say you're supposed to be savoring your food, and at the same time, the slow life movement is saying you're supposed to be savoring your life. So I love this. So I started thinking, well, the slow life movement, that's so exciting. And, you know, what would a slow family look like? And what would a slow school look like? And a slow business place. In Japan, where this has caught on, there's one governor of one of the towns, which they have the employees, the city workers, put on their cards, take it easy. It's in Japanese, but isn't that incredible? I mean, nobody in the States would do that, you know, encouraging your employees, your workers to take it easy. And so this is beginning to spread around. So what I wanted to do is to say, well, how can we do this? How can we live more slowly and more fully and enjoying our lives? And the thing about voluntary simplicity, which is a lot of they're involved, is it tends to focus more on very individual changes. And those are good. We need to have personal change. But it's harder to look at the whole cultural change. I think that's what the slow life movement does, is it looks at the whole thing and several levels of change. And so we have to ask, I think, one, why we're rushing around. One of my favorite books is called American Mania, When More Is Never Enough. And it's by Peter Weibrow, who's head of the UCLA Neuropsychiatric Institute. And so what he has looked at is the effects of all this rushing around. And he says, we're just up against the wall. We can't go any faster. This is having a horrible effect on us. And we know that it affects our health. That's pretty well known. It affects our relationships. And there's a quiz I always like to ask people. And so if you know the answer to this, don't give it. Just guess. And they did it, some research, and they did this on married couples, and they said, you know, how much time do married couples talk to each other each day? So I just want to hear some guesses, not if you know the right answer. How much time do married couples talk to each other each day, do you think? Because people usually ask me, does this include email? And when somebody asked me that, I thought, oh, wow, you know, if I really want to get my husband's attention, if I want to know that he's going to retain it, even though he's in the next room, I send him an email because I think he'll take that in. I can't tell if he's listening, you know, but I can tell he'll read my email. So anyway, how much time do you think what do you want to guess?
5 minutes.
Okay, we got 5 minutes. Half an hour. 10 minutes. Oh, 30 minutes a week. Now, who is that you're sitting next to? Do you know her? Well, the answer is, and this is a while ago, so it's probably worse, the answer is 12 minutes. And I was giving a talk to a group of young women, all in their early 20s, and they weren't married, and I felt so bad because they all guessed 2 hours. And I had to tell them it was 12 minutes. And then I started thinking, again, I've been married for so long that my husband doesn't listen, so I have to repeat everything, which reduces me to 6 minutes. So that's probably closer to the truth. But this is having an effect on our relationships. It's having an effect on the environment. When you think about the fact that when we're always hurrying, we don't take time to either bicycle or walk or take transit. We get in our cars and go. And I always like to think of the time when Carter was president that we had a 55-mile-an-hour speed limit. And we couldn't stand it. We couldn't stand it. We had to make it. We had to get rid of that. And think what that would have meant in terms of oil usage, in terms of global warming, if we could have used less oil. In 1937, though, even though this seems like it's a modern problem, Virginia Woolf, in a book called Three Guineas, talked about what happens when people have no time. She said, if people are highly successful in their professions, they lose their sense. Sight goes, they have no time to look at pictures. Sound goes, they have no time to listen to music. Speech goes, they have no time for conversation. Humanity goes. Money making becomes so important that they must work by night as well as by day. Health goes, and so competitive do they become that they will not share their work with others, though they have more than they can do themselves. What then remains of a human being who has lost sight, sound, and a sense of proportion? Only a cripple in a cave. Isn't that incredible? In 1937? And it's just this, that she summed that up. I know. If you haven't read Three Guineas, it's a wonderful book, and it's one of my favorite kind. It's very thin. I only like to read really thin books these days. And so the biggest effect this time poverty has is on our ability to experience happiness. Happiness has been on the decline for the last several years. And one of my favorite books on this, it's called The Loss of Happiness in Market Democracies by Robert Lane, who is a Yale emeritus professor. And he just brings all this literature together about happiness and shows that how it's been on the decline. Now, when we want to think about, though, what is the cause of this? What is the cause of our long work hours? How has this happened? First of all, because there technology is one of the causes of this fast-paced life, but the long work hours are one of the main ones. And there are different groups. There are some people who are doing this, who are working long hours because they absolutely love to do this. It doesn't usually last very long. It says that it lasts for men for about 3 to 5 years, and for women only 1 year, that they want to just really work themselves to death. There was an article recently in the Harvard Business Review talking about extreme jobs, like extreme sports. And they were talking about people working 70 hours a week. And then one man, they quoted, said, 70 hours a week in our company, that's just the first 3 days. And he was proud of it. You know, it was some sort of a macho, I don't know what it was. So there's that group, and then there's the group that they're just not earning enough, and so they have to work long hours because they have maybe 2 or 3 jobs put together. Then there's another group maybe who has bought in to all the consumerism and is in debt. In the States right now, and a lot of things I say are statistics based on the United States, and hopefully you guys are still better than us, but that this is a cautionary tale. That this is the direction people want you to go in. that our savings rate now is at 0%. We, on average, save nothing, and it frequently dips below. And this is the lowest savings rate since the Depression, before the Depression. So there's that group. Now, I won't say that all the people are just are in debt just because they've consumed a lot. A lot of people, because they have, are in debt because of a health emergency, since we have no national health insurance, and more people have no insurance in the United States. So there's that group. And then there's the group that I think is more most people, that they work the long hours because they're afraid if they don't, they'll be laid off. And so we have a tremendous people being laid off. And that, I don't know if you know this. Do you know what our average vacation is in the States? And what is yours? 3 to 4 weeks. And then you just now have a new law for parental leave, don't you? A year. Now, in all of these things, we have absolutely no policies on any of these. And our average vacation is 2 weeks, and that last year we took 40% of people did not take any, they didn't take their 2 weeks at all. 30% of working women have no paid vacation. So it keeps shrinking. Some of you know about the Take Back Your Time campaign, and on October 24th is Take Back Your Time Day in the States, and that's the day if we didn't work for the rest of the year until January 1st, we'd be working the same amount of time as the average European, that we work an average 9 weeks more. And this takes in paid vacation, it takes in parental leave, and things of those sort. So hopefully you're not going to come in this direction. So when we ask, why do these long work hours exist? In a sense, I would say that we have created a ruthless economy in the States where people, we know this, profit without principles, that there isn't another thing that weighs in on that. And so I was trying to think, why did this happen? Why did we kind of give a free pass to, you know, people making as much money as they want? You know, our CEO is over 400 times as much as the average worker. Why did this happen? And you can see that it's part of our belief system. And one of the beliefs is, and this is kind of a universal belief, but it's really true in the States, that if you're rich, you'll be happy. And that most Americans believe that if they're rich, they will be happy. And all of the happiness research shows that after a certain point, that doesn't happen, that more does not make you happier. But it's interesting, because I know that statistic, and we all of us probably have read about the winning the lottery. And that you know that after you win if you win the lottery, the first week you're ecstatic. But by the end of the year, you're not any happier than you were, and you may be less happy because you often lose a lot of your friends because you don't share it with them. And so, even knowing that, a lot of us, and I'm sure, you know, most of us don't buy a lottery ticket, a lot of us have this feeling, though, if I were suddenly rich, I'd be an exception. I would indeed be happier because I would know how to manage the money. And so we have this really deep inside us. And I don't know, and it'd be interesting if we have time to talk about this later, if this is true for Canadians, because it's so much a part of the American dream. You're going to be happy if you're rich. The other part of our false belief system is that we think, 80% of Americans think that if they work hard enough, they can be rich. 80%, it's like totally untrue. And 30% think they can be in the top 2%. The top 1% in our country has as much wealth as the bottom 90%. So there's no way. But the reason I say this is because since we believe this, when Bush gives tax cuts to the rich, nobody protests because they think, I could be rich and I'd be happy. And so someday they could be rich and happy. And so our belief system And it's interesting because people have often thought of this as the American dream. And this all used to be true a long time ago. But one of the things I ran across, I love this idea, that when countries keep doing what used to work and don't look at it, ask if it still works, that's when they're going into decline. And so I think this is fascinating to look at why we have this rush and that we are working and we're willing to work all these hours. So given this as the cause, how do we change? What do we do? And again, to look at the happiness literature, it seems like every other new book these days is about happiness, which basically shows that people aren't very happy, right? And so what the happiness literature says is the thing that makes people happy, it's not money after a certain point, it's relationships with other people. And even when you think, well, what about the sense of meaning or a sense of having a passion, or usually those are all related to other people. And so it seems to me that the core of this new vision that we have to have of the slow life has to have around it this commitment to relationships. And so with the subtitle of my book, New Visions of Community, Leisure, and Joie de Vivre, that the whole thing of community is central. And I have this quote from Robert Lane, the man that I referred to, who did The Decline of Happiness and Market Democracies. He says, "My hypothesis is that there is a kind of famine of warm interpersonal relations, of easy-to-reach neighbors, of encircling inclusive memberships, and of solidary family life. There is much evidence that for people lacking in social support of this kind, unemployment has more serious effects, illnesses are more deadly, disappointment with one's children is harder to bear, bouts of depression last longer, and frustration and failed expectations of all kinds are more traumatic. Thus," he says, "a weak version of the metaphoric flu will then do the damage of a more virulent strain, because people without social support are less resistant." I just love the way he puts that together.
Kick back. You are listening to Cecil Andrews, author of Slow is Beautiful, on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver.
And so the first thing I think we have to have in this new vision of the slow life is this focus on community. And when we finish, I want to ask you the question, and you can put this in the back of your mind, of thinking of a time when you have experienced community in your life. And it's so fun to think about those and what this involved. And one of them I can think is, I loved the experience of community living in graduate student housing. I just love graduate student housing, because there you had, what struck me is what you had was you had immediate access to people, that my kids could run out and play with other kids. I had, like, the people who lived next door were from France, and I could go next door and borrow a bottle of wine. I mean, when can you just hop over and borrow a bottle of wine? Or maybe you can still do that in Canada. I wouldn't think of doing that in my neighborhood. And this feeling that we were all pretty equal. We were all kind of facing a common enemy, the school. And it was like, it was just this feeling of having these ready-made relationships. And so when trying to define what is the heart of community, it seems to me it is having some place where you feel immediately accepted, that you feel that you can, you're valued as a person. And in our competitive society, we don't have that a whole lot. They did recently a comparison of the longevity of people in England and people in the States. And England had longer longevity than us. And apparently in Europe, they thought that was funny because the Europeans, I mean, English are less healthy than the Europeans. But they said it was because they had less stress, more exercise, but the key thing was they had more friends. And I don't know if you heard this, also another study recently. Again, it was about the United States, where they said that our number of friends, intimate friends, has been cut in half in the last like 10 or 20 years, that we used, friends that you could feel like you could reach out to in an emergency, that we used to have an average of 4, now we only have 2, and a quarter of Americans don't have any. So this sense of the aloneness that people have. So community has to be at the top of this new vision. And then leisure. Now this was the exciting one to read about because, you know, what, it's interesting to think of what comes to your mind when you think of leisure. And when I used to think about the concept of leisure, what would first come to my mind was leisure suits. You may remember leisure suits? You know, polyester pantsuits. And I thought, now, isn't that interesting that that's what I would think of? And then I realized that the concept of leisure has been diminished. It's been trivialized. Leisure is something that we do, you know, to get back to work. It's basically an escape. But when I was doing the research, I realized that all through human history, all the philosophers saw leisure as the most important thing in life. Like this was it. This is what you were alive for. And often it had something to do with looked like you were doing nothing. You were just sitting around. But what you were doing is that you were kind of soaking in life. And Whitman, Walt Whitman said, "I loaf and invite my soul." And it's just this incredible vision. And then I had this experience last year, last summer. And, you know, I can talk to you guys about this because we have pretty much the same climate, Seattle and Vancouver. And not very pleasant winters, I don't think, but they're not that cold. But our summers are absolutely incredible, aren't they? And I was sitting, I was in my backyard, and I had just hung my sheets out to dry. And it was a beautiful sunny day, and it was just a teeny breeze. So I was sitting in my outdoor lounge chair, and I realized after 45 minutes that I'd spent the whole time just watching my sheets dry. And I was kind of, I thought, whoa, you know, because there was this, the sheets would kind of billow out a teeny bit, and you could literally see them getting lighter as the water evaporated. And I thought, wow, that was great. And then I realized that if I had done that a few years earlier, I would have been like, oh my God, I just wasted 45 minutes. I could have read this or written this. You know, nothing about cleaning my refrigerator. That has never been one of them. But it was like that I thought I'd really made progress. And whenever we come, like tonight we're here visiting and staying in the Sylvia, and we love to stay in the Sylvia, and particularly in the summer. And it's always nice, you know, during the summer it'll be about, you know, it changes, of course, 8 or 9. You see people out there finding their log to sit on. And at first I kind of wondered, and I watched, and I saw, and nobody was talking, and I saw everybody was sitting there to watch the sun go down. And it was always very quiet, and people are just sitting there. And I thought, this is leisure. And this is what they're talking about. So it's doing things like gardening or quilting or sitting there or writing poetry and all of these things. This is a thing that's at the bottom of people's lists because they have to be busy. So this idea, excuse me, of leisure was very inspiring to see, like, this is the whole point. So we have community, leisure, and again, you'll recognize the phrase joie de vivre. My publisher is Canadian, and they said, you know, Cecile, I don't think we can use this phrase, joie de vivre, you know, French for the joy of living, because nobody knows what it means. And I thought, well, wow, people in the States used to know what it means. And it's not that we're speaking less French, because we've never spoken any French. And I realized, I started thinking, you know how the Eskimos have a lot of words for snow? Because they've got a lot of snow. Well, we don't have any words for joie de vivre because we don't have much. And so nobody really understands. So, you know, when I get interviewed on a radio, they can't even pronounce it. And it's like, this is like the basic energy for life, isn't it? That we have to have that sense of excitement and zest. of exuberance, and that when this goes, I one of the books I use is called Called Exuberance. It's by Jameson, who was a MacArthur fellow at Johns Hopkins. She calls it the wine of the gods, that when it runs out, so does a culture. And I don't see a whole lot of joie de vivre in the States. In fact, we're all kind of fighting to not be depressed most. In fact, you probably know that depression has spiked. It's gone up tenfold. And you know one of the places it's particularly gone up? And I think this is going to get people's attention. There's a new book out called The Price of Privilege, and it's about Marin County teenagers. The woman who wrote it, Madeline... but anyway, she's a therapist in Marin County, and of course it's one of the richest counties in the country, that the highest rate of suicide in terms of age are those teenage kids there because of the pressure on them, and that they look like they have everything. But one of the things they have is no time, because they're constantly pressured. Their whole lives are, what can I put on my college application? So when we think, I found something that for me, captures what I mean by joie de vivre. And it's by Evelyn Underhill, and she was known for her book on mysticism. And this is a book from a book called Practical Mysticism, published in 1915. And she says it's a parable about eyes and no eyes, two different ways of looking at life. And she says that no eyes has fixed his attention on the fact that he is obliged to take a walk. For him, the chief factor of existence is his own movement along the road, a movement which he intends to accomplish as efficiently and comfortably as he can. He asks not to know what may be on either side of the hedges. He ignores the caress of the wind until it threatens to remove his hat. He trudges along steadily, diligently, avoiding the muddy pools, but oblivious of the light which they reflect. Eyes takes the walk too. And for him, it is a perpetual revelation of beauty and wonder. The sunlight inebriates him. The winds delight him. The very effort of the journey is a joy. Magic presences throng the roadside or cry salutations to him from the hidden fields. The rich world through which he moves lies in the foreground of his consciousness, and it gives up new secrets to him at every step. No eyes, when told of his adventures, usually refuses to believe that both have gone by the same road. He fancies that his companion has been floating about in the air or beset by agreeable hallucinations. We shall never persuade him to the contrary unless we persuade him to look for himself. Don't you love that? This whole difference. They're going the same way, but they're experiencing things differently. It's kind of the definition of joie de vivre. So we have this is what I see as the goal, the vision, community, leisure, and joie de vivre. And so now I want to talk to how do we do it, how do we get to that. And as I said, we need different levels of change, policy, kind of on the community level, the personal level. And in the Take Back Your Time movement, we're working more on the policy levels, that can we have a policy for vacation, for sick leave, for parental leave. But we also have to have policies for something else. And you know, every once in a while, like I can never remember facts very much. I just can't remember them. But every once in a while, an idea will come along that's so kind of exciting that it's just like, whoa. And one came along for me in the last couple of years. And you're probably familiar with it, but it's one I want everyone to know, that the biggest predictor of the health of a nation, as measured in terms of particularly longevity, which is a standard way of measuring health, is the gap between the rich and the poor. And I remember, I thought, what? What does this mean? That the bigger the gap is, the lower the longevity. In the United States in the 50s was one of the healthiest countries. And now, out of the industrialized nations, we're at the bottom. Our longevity is going down. And it's interesting because when you first hear that, you think, Well, that's because the poor don't have good health care or good health practices, so that brings down the average, which is part of it. But the biggest part of it is a rich person in the States doesn't have the same longevity as the average citizen does in Holland or Denmark, where there's a very egalitarian, very equal society. I just think that's an incredible thing. And what it is, remember the guy who wrote How Proust Can Change Your Life? I don't even know how to say it. Botton, Alain de Botton, something like that. He wrote a book called Status Anxiety. And he shows, and there are a lot of people working on this, that the thing that affects our health is this difference in status. That we're not treated well when other people have more status. And that then everybody is trying to, move up and live up to the Joneses. But now they don't compare themselves to the people living down the street. They compare themselves to the rich people. So everybody is feeling this lack of kind of security and happiness with who they are. And it gives them also less control over their lives. And I don't know if any of you have been someplace lately where you've been with lower status. But it's very painful. And I got my doctorate in education from Stanford. And I recently went back as a visiting scholar. Well, as I went back, a visiting scholar at Stanford, when you basically spend your life, working at a community college, I was like totally low status. And it was very strange to suddenly become invisible to people. I remember one day I was supposed to be talking to this person, and she would keep seeing somebody more important go by. And she would, hi, so-and-so, and so-and-so. She didn't introduce me. And it was, I wanted to, grab her face and hold it there. My son was little, if he wanted it, he would grab my face. But it was very painful to be a very low status person. And in this country, there's almost always somebody, and I say this, I really mean the States, there's almost always somebody who has higher status. And so what it does is it creates this feeling of kind of like greed or envy or resentment. And those aren't healthy emotions. So I just think that this idea that what it's saying is equality is best. So this is one of the big policy changes we need. Now, I also, a lot of you, of course, know Bertrand Russell. And in the 30s, he wrote something called In Praise of Idleness. And he felt that we should be working 4-hour days, 20-hour weeks. And yeah, get that. It's my favorite book. It's a little short pamphlet in praise of idleness. But this is what he has to say about working 4 hours a day. He says, above all, there will be happiness and joy of life instead of frayed nerves, weariness, and dyspepsia. Don't you love that, dyspepsia? I think we should start working that into our conversations. See, I have to go home. I'm feeling dyspeptic. And they won't know what you mean, so you'll have to leave because they won't be clear. They won't want to ask. He goes on to say, the work exacted will be enough to make leisure delightful, but not enough to produce exhaustion. Since men will not be tired in their spare time, they will not demand only such amusements as are passive and vapid. At least 1% will probably devote the time not spent in professional work to pursuits of some public importance. And since they will not depend upon these pursuits for their livelihood, their originality will be unhampered, and there will be no need to conform to the standards set by elderly pundits. Don't you love that? But it is not only in these exceptional cases that the advantages of leisure will appear. Ordinary men and women, having the opportunity of a happy life, will become more kindly and less persecuting and less inclined to view others with suspicion. The taste for war will die out, partly for this reason, and partly because it will involve long and severe work for all. Good nature is, of all moral qualities, the one that the world needs most. And good nature is the result of ease and security, not of a life of arduous struggle. Modern methods of production have given us the possibility of ease and security for all. We have chosen, instead, to have overwork for some and starvation for others. Hitherto, we have continued to be as energetic as we were before there were machines. In this, we have been foolish. But there's no reason to go on being foolish forever. You love that?
Kick back. You are listening to Cecil Andrews, author of Slow is Beautiful on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver.
And there's this whole literature of course, the working shorter work week. And it's very inspiring, and that people have been talking about this for such a long time. And so we need policies, and then we also need to create change at the community level. And you probably know, if you know about the slow food movement, you probably know about the slow cities movement. And again, I think that's so inspiring that and it's, of course, again, started in Italy. If there are other cities throughout Europe. But the whole point is it's part of their marketing that you can become a slow city and you have to fulfill certain obligations. And one is to try to get the cars out of downtown and to create lots of places for people to sit, have coffee, to hang out, and to get people to shop local and to encourage the employees to take their lunch hours. And so you have, again, this vision of people taking their time and talking to each other and walking slowly. And this is still happening to Europe, but of course there's the push always to make people work longer and in danger that you know, where does the siesta still exist? And then some of you know about co-housing is another community level change. Eco-villages, and I work with something that is called the Finney Eco-Village. And this is, we think of it as a Finney, an eco-village light. Because it's kind of like Bud Light. It's not a real eco-village. Because most eco-villages they're out in the country and they're raising stuff together and living together, usually in an intentional community. But I live in this neighborhood that I love in North Seattle, near Green Lake, if any of you know Seattle. And there's no way I ever want to leave it. And so I thought, can I have the advantages of an eco-village in my neighborhood? And I discovered we spend a lot of time in the Bay Area in California, and there's something in Oakland, an Oakland eco-village, and all they're trying to do is this build this community. And so we've been working on this for a couple of years, and it was interesting because the different things we've started, like I worked with a local community center, and when I went to tell them about what I wanted to do, they said, one of them said, oh yes, and he wanted to be the eco-village idiot. And somebody else said, we can have the, you know, eco-village singers. And so we started, we want this to be build sustainability and community. And we do a lot of different things, but one of the things that we do is that we work with, like, a lot of local businesses, and we work with a local bookstore, and we have something that we call Santoro Salon. And what this is, again, is to try to bring people together to get them talking. And this one is like, we think of it as a slow book group. And my favorite thing is the what we call, this is a totally easy thing to do, is we call it our stop and chat campaign. We want to get people out in the neighborhood, walking, talking to each other. And we got the name. I don't know if any of you saw Curb Your Enthusiasm with Larry David, the Seinfeld writer. But he's this, like, really curmudgeonly guy. He hates to run into people. He hates a stop and chat. He goes across the street when he sees somebody he knows. But what we want to do is say no. And so this has become a goal for us. And so when my husband gets home late, whereas he used to get in trouble, now he'll say, I had 3 stop and chats, and he's off the hook. Because that's what he's been doing. So these are some of the things in the community level. Of doing things that bring people together in community with leisure, with joie de vivre. And that this has, I think, not only tremendous, you know, ramifications for people's sense of well-being, but of how they treat other people, of how they'll treat the environment. And so this effort has been, again, so enjoyable to do. But now let's talk for our last few minutes of some of the individual things you can do, because we all want to be able to make a change in our own lives. The biggest for me, of course, is being in the simplicity movement for a long time, you know, spending less so I could work less. And so many years ago, I was a community college administrator. I quit that job. And it's interesting because it, working costs a lot of money. You know, as some people list, you know, it's not only the clothes and the daycare and the commuting. Somebody said it also for therapists or for divorce. And so it's amazing how much money I've saved since I quit working. And so that's one thing. But even a lot of us in the simplicity movement are still rushing around, even though we've tried to work less and to spend less. And so I want to give you some of the things. The first thing I think we need to do is to try to quit hurrying. You know, it's such an automatic thing. And I remember when I was still working, you know, full time, I'd go in and, you know, I'd get on the elevator and I'd push the floor and then I'd push closed door. I don't think that button does anything. Really, you know, they just put it there for us anxious types to think that we're doing something. And so each morning I try to get myself not to push the closed door button. And I never could do it. I would push floor, why not closed door? And it was absurd. It's beginning to see. So to quit rushing, to just get on that elevator and just stand there. Or take the stairs, you don't have to face it. Isn't this ridiculous? But to spend all this emotional energy on something, you're just upset and you don't go faster. And if you go faster, it doesn't matter anyway, because you don't get there any sooner. If you did, you wouldn't be happier. So then the whole thing, as I said, the whole thing on to-do lists, this, you know, crossing things out even if you haven't done them, it's interesting to discuss with people their philosophy of to-do lists. Because I've discovered that some people cheat on their to-do list. They do. They tell me what they put on things like, get up, take a shower, get dressed, and they feel ahead of the day. Maybe it is good. They feel like they've gotten something done. Or somebody else said at the end of the day, they add things that they did so they can check them off. And then I heard, There's this one comedian, and he says, he goes over to people's houses, and he finds their to-do list on their refrigerator, and he adds things. He says he puts on things like, bomb the Pentagon. And so again, it's like we have to look at these absurd behaviors. And so we have to learn new time management skills. Most of them are like how to do more faster and how to multitask. That's usually what the advice is. But it's we want not efficiency, but enjoyment. And we discovered, this was obviously years ago because of before we had email. And we were always trying to figure out, you know, how we could get out of things that we didn't want to do. And we had planned a party, and it was becoming to seem like too much. So we called up everybody, and we canceled the party. And as we would tell them, people would respond with like, oh, well, that's too bad. And I realized they were happy to have it canceled because they had a free evening. So then I thought, that's what you can do if you want to make people happy. Cancel something, right? If you're a supervisor at work, call a meeting, cancel it. Your morale, wouldn't your morale go right up with that? Essentially what it is the art of looking at things and asking yourself, do I really need to do these things? Because we seem like we spend a lot of our time doing useless things. We also need to learn to hang out. Again, this is very hard for Americans. And once I'd given a workshop and a German woman came up afterwards and she said, you know what the chief difference is between our cultures? And here we were in Seattle. She held up a latte cup. And she said, in our culture, when we have a latte, we take a couple of hours to have coffee with our friends and talk with our friends. But you, You use it for fuel. You're getting a to-go latte from a drive-thru espresso stand, and you're drinking it alone in your car. I mean, isn't that an incredible image of what we've become? And then somebody said that, well, I was in an airport once, and there was it was a big poster for a car, and all it said on it was, yes, it has cup holders. And somebody told me that in Europe, they don't even make their cars with cup holders. And then somebody told me that they knew about an SUV that had 30 cup holders in it. And you know how SUVs turn over, roll over more easily? So I'd like to imagine these people hanging upside down with coffee all over them. But again, we have to look at how bizarre that we're behaving. And all these things are very, very strange. I think another thing we have to do is learn to lower our standards and things. It used to be in the 80s, everybody would have these very elaborate dinner parties. And I'd always think when people would have us over, I'd think, I can't have them back, you know, because I can't do this. And then when you get, though, involved in the simplicity movement, nobody expects anything from you. They don't expect you to have your kitchen remodeled. I can wear the same clothes day after day. And they're just thinking, oh, she's simplifying her life. And so I realized that I started having potlucks. And first I felt kind of strange having potlucks, like, you know, telling everybody else to bring the food. And then I realized that all my friends knew I wasn't a good cook, and they probably rather bring the food. And then I realized that there's a different feel when everybody is doing it together. And so you start doing something. And so I never worry about having my house perfect, because I know everybody then comes and feels really kind of good about themselves, because they think, oh, well, look at her house. And then I've thought of even easier ways of entertaining, because I feel like if I just spent the rest of my life like having parties and potlucks, I'd be doing more to contribute to social change than almost anything. So we came up with one. We called it Newsnight. And we just had all of our friends bring a clipping that they had read. You know how you'll read something in the paper and you want to talk to somebody about it? And so people loved it. And I would never have any food. I wouldn't do anything. I'd give them tea. And what I discovered was people started bringing things. I didn't have to ask them. But now we've discovered something even easier. You know, there's so many documentaries out now, like Who Killed the Electric Car and things like that. So that's what we do now for our entertaining. We show one of those movies, and somebody else brings the popcorn. I mean, what could be easier? And so this having people over is really important, but you have to figure out a way to make it really easy. And what I want to do is I'm going to close with an example, and then we'll have some discussion. And particularly, I like to hear how people have really slowed down. And I was realizing that one of the things that we need is a new role model, a new kind of a sense of a hero. And like, you know, now in the age of celebrities, I mean, is Donald Trump somebody we want to look up to? You know, we've got to have different people we look up to. And there's a book by a man named Lin Yutang, who was writing again in the 30s. They wrote don't you love Lin Yutang? They wrote a lot of this stuff in the 30s, because obviously with the Depression, they were rethinking the whole way we did things. And he says that we have to have a new kind of hero, and he calls him a scamp. And the scamp isn't somebody who's trying to be an important person or to win. A scamp wants to enjoy life. And this is what he says. In this present age of threats to democracy and individual liberty, probably only the scamp and the spirit of the scamp alone will save us from becoming lost as serially numbered units in the masses of disciplined, obedient, regimented, uniformed coolies. The scamp will be the last and the most formidable enemy of dictatorships. He will be the champion of human dignity and individual freedom, and will be the last to be conquered. All modern civilization depends entirely upon him. So I was trying to think of who are examples of scamps. And I was thinking of some movies, and thinking, of course, of Maude and Harold and Maude, mm-hmm. which some young people haven't seen, Or the other one, which young people haven't seen, but you can rush right out and get these, is Zorba the Greek. Remember, Zorba is a scamp in there. I won't give you the ending, but it's a great one of basically not trying to get rich and famous, but to enjoy their lives. So then I tried to think of a real-life scamp, and the person I came up with is Kurt Vonnegut. I saw him one night not long ago on the Jon Stewart show, and he was just as fiery as it ever been. And so I found a quote of his, and it's in a little essay he wrote, and he talks about the way he lives his life. He still does his writing on a typewriter. And after he writes, then he calls up the woman who edits his work and chats with her for a little while and then asks her, can he send it in? Can he send it to her? She says, yes, send it all over. And then he goes to the stationery store and he has to buy the envelope and he stands in line again. He chats with everyone and then he goes to the post office and he says he's secretly been in love with the postmistress for many years, but she's never realized it. And of course, there he chats with everyone and then he goes home and it's noon. His wife says, your morning's gone. What have you done? Get a computer. You wouldn't have to do all this. You could just write and send it off, and you'd have extra time to do more work. And he says, and then what would my life be like? He says, we're on this earth to fart around and don't let anybody tell you any different. Thank you. The important thing is that we should be talking about all of these issues. And so I want to close with some recommendations that whatever you can do, find a way, again, to start conversations. And that this really, Etzioni, the sociologist, says that you change the world through a metalogue, a conversation. John Dewey, on his 90th birthday, said democracy begins in conversation. So you try to figure out. And one day I noticed, I was watching my husband, and he has these hemp shorts that everybody always thinks are really cute. And so he always starts conversations. And I watched him one day, and granted this was in a Whole Foods in Mill Valley, California, but I looked at him over there, and they were talking to him about his shorts. And then the cashier was saying, it's the corporations that won't let us have it. And then the person bagging it was saying, and it's so good for the environment. And I thought to myself, my husband has started a little revolution in the grocery line. And so I started thinking of this as grocery line activism, that when you get in, you start a conversation with somebody. And then I started thinking, well, another way you could do it, you know, if you hear people when they're using their cell phones on the bus and they're talking really loud, which makes a bus ride more interesting, really. But I think you could really do a lot. You just take your cell phone. You wouldn't have to have anybody at the other end of it. You know, you could be saying really in a loud voice, did you see what Bush did? Or could you say something about global warming? Or you could, and you could get people around you would get involved in talking. And so whenever you can do that, that you are making a difference. You're making a difference every time you talk to people, every time you listen to people, every time you smile at somebody, every time that you laugh about something. And so everybody wants to feel they're making a difference and having a good time. And so I think we can do this by having the slow life. So thank you for coming tonight.
You've been listening to Cecil Andrews, author of Slow is Beautiful, New Visions of Community, Leisure, and Joie de Vivre. She spoke at the Vancouver Public Library on March 5th, 2007. We'd like to thank the Necessary Voices Society for this recording. Find out more about their excellent series of public talks by visiting www.necessaryvoices.org. Join us next Tuesday at noon for more of the best speeches of Vancouver on the local Brown Bagger. This is CFRO Co-op Radio, 102.7 FM in Vancouver.